Have you ever been in a situation where you were closed out? You came up and the door closed and you were on the outside. It's not a fun place to be. I had that situation happen a few years ago. It was actually on a trip for the church. We were doing a mission trip and a part of what was going on, and we were doing some tours of the Holy Land and things, and we had several people at the church group together with us, and things had happened as they do with groups and transportation, and we'd gotten delayed, and there'd been some backups, and so we were late getting in, and we'd been on this, you know, long flight, international flight, land at Kennedy, and we can make our flight if we run. So here we are, about 20 of us, we are running through, you know, JFK, you know, and we actually have to go out of one terminal and down and into another terminal, and, you know, you're looking at your watch and you're saying, you know, hey, we're going to make it, and, you know, the whole thing is you've got to be there 10 minutes before or else they, you know, okay. And true story, literally, I'm running down that hallway looking at the gate and I see the girl go over to close the door. And I yell, I say, we're coming. And we'd already talked to the airline in advance. And, you know, they knew about our delayed flight and that we were on our way. And we had this, you know, group and all that. And she turned and she looked at me and she saw us running and she just went click and closed the door. And I got up to the desk. I said, hey. And she goes, no, we've already closed the door. It's too late. I went, you know, she goes, no, you're past the 10-minute mark. I went, you're kidding. I was not real happy at that moment. You know, I'm trying to remember my position and all the people there. I really, you know, was working not to say something stupid that I wanted to say or anything like that. You know, I tried, you know, seriously, is there anybody we can talk to? There's got to be a way. And, you know, the whole time I know what's happening and they're getting the plane, they'll finish and they're closing the door. And sure enough, the plane backs away from the gate and there we stood. So we now had to make all the arrangements for the 20 people to, you know, it was like 3 hours to get all the different flights and arrangements and rebooked on that. Are you kidding me? I mean, really? And I know that there are some reasons and they, you know, that she saw us coming. I, oh, we're not going to do it. We're not going to make it happen. We're going to close the door. You're too late. It's a horrible feeling. Why do I tell you that story? We are about to go into the last of our discussions about this belief statements. We've been doing it for a little over a year. Belief is big as life. And we looked last week at Satan. And by the way, I have to say kind of an interesting thank you, I guess is the right word. I told you at the beginning of last week that I didn't want to preach that message. It's not fun. It's not easy. It's weird to preach on Satan like that. I had so many of you that either through email or through text or through comments that were made talked about the fact that she appreciated that. It's, I guess, really not often that we do speak honestly about the devil and his influences. And some of you commented on the whole, so we think the devil is red, let's use that. And we did the little acronym and, you know, that somebody went out saying, I remembered that, you know. He's real, he's an enemy. He is deceitful, and he is defeated, you know, the R-E-D-D. And so I just want to say thank you, because it was not one of those messages that you really enjoy preaching, but it was one that I think we seem to have good understanding of. We're coming into the last piece, if you will. You know, we've talked about God and Christ and the church and salvation, and last week about the spiritual warfare thing. We're going to be talking for a couple of weeks on what's next. And there's probably nothing in the Christian community that is as controversial and sometimes divisive and as confusing as what's next. Talk about last things, about prophecy, about the second coming of Christ. And I think partly that's because it's not here, so we can all speculate, and nobody can say you're wrong because it hasn't happened yet. So people, you know, get caught up in their interpretations. Plus, we all like that feeling that we've got some special inside track on the future. We know what's coming. And boy, doesn't that make us feel good or proud or special or I don't know, whatever. But there's probably been more ink spilled in theological writing and probably more gray matter lost in theological discussion about what's coming than about any other topic in all of the Christian life and Christian experience. Today we're going to come and celebrate the Lord's table. And there's something that Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 11 when he was discussing the Lord's table. And he actually said in that passage, you know, as he's saying that he was giving to us what he had received from the Lord. He said, "As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again." It's an amazing statement. We're going to look a little bit more at that in a few minutes. What it means to say we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again. But it's that second part of the statement, until he comes again, that is so critical. And we need to understand what it is we're thinking about there. I'm going to ask if you would to open your copy of God's Word to Matthew chapter 25. Now, Matthew 24 and 25, if the topic is something on which a lot of ink has been spilled and gray matter lost in publishing and discussions and theorizing and wrestling to understand what it means about Christ's coming, then perhaps Matthew 24 and 25 are where most of it has been lost. It's just really hard to understand this passage. And to put it in a context, Luke, as he's talking about this, lets us know that it's a series of discussions Jesus had with his disciples, usually in the evenings over on the Mount of Olives. So theologians call this passage the Olivet Discourse. So if you ever see that or come across that, at least you know what we're talking about. We're talking about this time when the disciples were saying to Jesus, "What's next? What's next?" And so Jesus wanted to answer them. Now, the challenge that we face in studying this is that Jesus didn't sit down and give them a chronology. He gave them some vignettes, some small snapshots or pictures, and he kind of said, well, this is going to be, and this is going to be, and this is going to be. But he didn't link them all together in a perfect order. So people have been trying to do that and say, well, what happens when, and what happens where, and how does it all unfold? And you know, it's created all kinds of discussion and sometimes division and controversy among the church. Which pieces apply and how do they apply and who's who in the process? We're going to look at some of these things, and of course we're going to look at some of the stuff, especially like Book of Revelation things and Book of Daniel things, and we're going to talk about a few of these things as we look forward to understanding what Scripture tells us about what's next. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and make a fairly bold statement. And in some ways I mean it to be kind of humorous and a little bit fun, easy to hang on to for us as we think about what's next in our Christian lives, but in another way, I mean it to be very, very serious, because I think that too often we have let these issues become divisive and even destructive to the church and not really grasp the central theme. So in all of our discussion about the coming of Christ and the what's next in our Christian experience, I would like to have us remember this simple statement. Jesus is coming again. And he will do it when and how he wants to. And we will all say, that was cool. Think about it for just a minute. Jesus is coming again. And he will do it when and how he wants to. And when he does, we will all say, that was cool. That was great. That was good, Jesus. When Jesus comes back again, I'm not going to suddenly say to him, now, wait a minute, Jesus, you didn't do that according to the theological plan that I laid out in my understanding of how the tribulation or how the second coming or how the kingdom is going to unfold. I'm not going to stand up and debate him at that time. He's going to do it how he wants and when he wants, and I'm going to say, that was cool. And if we keep that in mind, as we go through some of these discussions and say, yes, it's all right for us to wrestle with what he told us, it will keep us from thinking we've got an answer that somebody else doesn't have, because the only one who truly has an answer to how this plays out is Jesus himself. And we need never forget that. It is so easy for us to get caught up in our desire to know and to be the ones with the special knowledge, the secret, you know, Jedi mind knowledge of what's going to happen. You know, we've got the force with us of what's going to happen. That was a reference for all the people who remember what day yesterday was. Oh, some of you laughed. Some of you know. May the 4th be with you. Yes? Star Wars Day yesterday? Oh, yeah. We're all nerds. Oh, yeah, I love it. You know, some of us, you know, get so caught up in that idea, we've got the knowledge, we've got this. And we start to think that that's what it's about. And my friends, it's really not. What it's about is knowing that Jesus is coming back. He will do it when and how he wants, and we will all say, that was great. That was cool. So I hope we can keep that perspective in mind as we go through our discussions. Look with me, if you will, then, at Matthew 24 and 25 for just a minute. In this passage, Jesus is talking to his disciples about some things related to what's next and to the coming kingdom of God. And in particular, in chapter 25, we have a simple story. And I want to start by saying this story is a parable. That's important to keep in mind as we start to interpret these things, because a parable is not meant to be a specific series of detailed teachings about an issue. A parable is meant to be a general and practical illustration that allows people to understand a key point of truth. It's a way of simply and practically teaching an idea so that everybody can hang on to it. It's just so plain and so clear, you can't miss it. And I think sometimes what happens is we get caught up in our study of the Word of God and our commitment to the literal and accurate interpretation of the Word of God. We sometimes get so caught up in that we start looking for things that aren't really there and that Jesus didn't really mean. One of my favorite, you know, illustrations of understanding this is, yes, it's true. Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches. But I'm so thankful that didn't mean I was going to turn all woody and leafy. You know, I didn't suddenly become something that was physically full of leaves and sap. You know, that would have been really messy and not fun. What Jesus is saying there is a relationship. It's a figure of speech. It's an illustration to communicate an idea. And it says we are integrally related to Christ as the source of our nourishment and the source of our life and the source of our structure and idea and identity in the same way a branch is related to a vine. That's all it's saying. It's a simple illustration to highlight a relationship. And we don't need to move beyond that to hear what Jesus is saying. And then we take all the things he says, we put them together, and we get into a sense of what he wants us to know and where he wants us to go. A lot of times parables are that way. And I think one of the things that's created so much difficulty for people who are looking at like the Olivet Discourse and these things about the future is they try to make every little detail mean more than maybe Jesus meant it to mean. And I want to kind of caution us against that. So coming back again, remember the big idea here is that Jesus is coming back. He will do it when and how he wants, and we will all say, that was cool. That was good. Okay. So in this passage, you start a little bit by realizing that the disciples have been pushing him and asking him, when are these things going to come to pass? When is the kingdom of God going to come about? And he's been giving them some ideas about how this will happen. And he's talking about some hardships, some tribulations that will come, and some times of real pressure and discouragement. And then he also talks about how there will be times of blessing and times of great reward, and also some judgments will be in there. He kind of mixes it all together as he says there's a lot of things happening. He says two things that get us, I think, into some of the conflict. In chapter 24, verses 32 through 35, he talks about a lesson of a fig tree. He goes, you can tell what season of a year it is by looking at the tree. And when you see that the summer is near, you see that the branch becomes tender and it puts out its leaves and it's the springtime. And I was just actually up in Chicago with my daughter, and they had, you know, some of the trees just beginning to bud. They're a couple weeks behind us, and you know, we had ours down here that just recently came into bloom, and you go, oh yeah, it's spring. And so, you know, Jesus says essentially, look for the signs and you'll see some warning that things are coming. But then he immediately right after that in verse 36 says, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven or the Son, but the Father only. He says, yeah, he goes, there's some sense in which we'll see changes that will let us know that things are getting serious. But understand this, no one knows. No one knows. That's an emphasis I really want to make. No one knows except the Father. That's why I say he will do what he wants, when he wants, and when it happens, we'll all go great. So we have to take those two tensions that he wants us to have some idea so we're ready, but no one knows. And we have to say, how do I hold those intentions? How do I live my Christian life when I think about Jesus coming back again? And to that end, he gives us a couple of other parables to work with. One of them you actually had Pastor Josh talk about a few weeks ago when I was traveling, and he talked about the talents and how we are to be using what God has given us, investing what God has given us for his glory in preparation. That's great. But another parable that's here that I think we ought to look at is the one that's beginning of verse in chapter 1, in verse 1 of chapter 25, at the beginning of chapter 25. And if your Bible is like mine, it'll say something like the parable of the virgins or the 10 virgins or the 10 bridesmaids, something like that. And by the way, I hope you do have your copy of God's Word. I didn't put them up on the screens, you know. We're not looking like we do at a whole bunch of verses flying by. And besides, sometimes it's good for us to take the text and actually open it up or turn it on. So I hope you have it. And if you don't have one, there's a Bible in the seat pockets or the seat racks in front of you. And please take that. That's our gift to you. We're all about the Bible here at Washington Heights. And if you don't know where some of these passages are, just ask somebody next to you who's either got their device turned on or has their Bible open, and they'll be glad to tell you. But Matthew chapter 25, Jesus tells this parable. He says, "Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, 'Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him.' Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out.' But the wise answered, saying, 'Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves.' And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came along, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he answered, 'Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour.'" I don't know about you. If you've been in the church for very long in your life, you maybe have heard messages on this passage. I've actually heard many over my life. And I will tell you, it gets very, very interesting to hear all the stories about how the wedding procession worked and what the customs of the day were and how there was this, you know, whole big entourage of the bride and the groom, and the groom was at his home or his parents' home, and the bride was at her home or her parents' home, and how the bridegroom came, and sometimes there were animals involved riding on horses or sometimes leading a caravan with a dowry on it, and you know, the bridegroom would come when things were prepared, and he'd collect his bride and all the families and have this huge procession back, and there'd be feasting and celebration, and so all along the way they start giving all these meanings and you know, who the bridegroom and what it means to be one of the attendants and all, and it gets very, very complicated. And it's all based on our knowledge of first century marriage customs. Can I tell you something? We know very little about first century marriage customs. You know, in our day and age, we make this huge thing about weddings because there's a whole lot of commerce involved. You know, there's caterers, and there's florists, and there's, you know, dressmakers, and there's tuxedo rental places, and there's vacation planners, and wedding event planners, and venues, and you know, oh, man, you know, it's years of planning and gobs of money, and so because of that, there's a whole industry, and those industries publish things like, you know, Brides Magazine, and, you know, they have all kinds of, you know, wedding events and weekends and, oh, you know, it's just crazy of shows wow. So we've got all kinds of information. And even with all of that, let me ask you this. Could you tell me what the wedding tradition for America is? Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of them out there. You can do your wedding big, small, destination, church, you know, all kinds of different vows. You can have colors and forms and ceremonies and vows and music, and it can all look different. And we're not even to the receptions yet and the catering and the VJs and the DJs and the you know, RJs and whatever the J's are. I don't know. And if you said, this is the way weddings are done in America in the 21st century, we'd be like, huh? Yeah. Same thing was true, actually, back then. Weddings could range in a number of ways, from just simply dad bringing the two together and say, you like him, you like her, okay, fine, you know, it's done. two, you know, very formal and large events, two great processions and banquets and all that went with it. We know kind of like what we know is that there are a few things that seem to be true. There seems to have been a way in which the groom was in charge. He was the one, not like our day where the bride is and it's her day. In this day, the groom was in charge. He was the one who was bringing this bride, this woman, into his family, and there were some things about that. So it would often be the groom who in one way or another would go and bring the bride. And they would come together, and then they would often have a celebration. And it might go on for a day, it might go on for several days, but there would be a celebration, some kind of feast, some kind of rejoicing, some kind of party, and that's about all we know. That's really about all we know. Everything else, I just have to tell you, as a historian myself, is a lot of speculation from a few very, very rare sources that we've been able to put together. And why do I stress that? I stress that because as people reading the text, we do ourselves a disservice if we start to try to bring all kinds of outside ideas in and say, well, Jesus meant this and Jesus meant this because in that culture they did this and in that culture they did the other thing. There are times when that's very good and helpful to us in understanding the text. But in this case, I don't think it is. In fact, I think it can be very misleading. I think what we have to do is let the text really just stand on its own and understand that Jesus was giving us a parable, a story, and what he wanted us to know was that story, not a lot of other things. He wanted us to know that story and get that point. When we stop and do that, the point becomes really pretty obvious. Like, you probably don't need me to say a lot more. So you say, why will you? Well, for fun. So what is this story? Well, it talks about these 10 virgins, 10 bridesmaids. And they usually were unmarried, they usually were virgins, they usually were maids, and so that would be the custom and the way of thinking about it. They didn't have to be, from all we understand. But what they were was they were the attendants to the bride. Now, as I said, in the culture we know is usually the groom who was in charge. So what were they to do? Well, they were to do what they were asked to do. And in this case, what the text tells us is they were asked to have the lamps. Now, the lamps were used for one very important purpose. That's to provide light when it was dark. Big idea, right? The lamps were there to provide light when it was dark. We say light for what? Well, if they were doing a procession, light for the procession, so that they could see where they were going on the street. If they were having a celebration, and this text indicates that they were having a feast and that it was held in a home because it talks about the door being shut. So they were to provide light in the venue, in the hall, in the feasting room. That's really all. There's nothing else about it except that, you know, everybody has a job to do. And these girls, these ladies, were asked to be the ones who provided the light. What's your job? My job is the light. I'm bringing the lights. I'm bringing the lamps so that when we get there, wherever we're going, we have light because this party's going to go into the night. Okay, so what's my job? To bring the light. Okay, cool. Now we know what it is. Nothing else is needed to be known here. Nothing else is needed to be known. I'm here to bring the light. And so the text goes on and it says there were these 10 light bringers, these 10 bridesmaids, 5 of whom were foolish and 5 of whom were wise. That's what Jesus wants us to hear. It's not about all the history and traditions and ceremonies of weddings. He says, I want you to hear that there are smart people and there are foolish people. And we're going to use this idea of the wedding as a way of understanding that there are wise people and foolish people. In this particular case, we're talking about the bridesmaids who have the job of providing light when it gets dark. Now, we got 10 of them. Is the number 10 important? No. Jesus could have said there were 12 of them, 6 and 6. He could have said there were 50 of them, 25 and 25. He could have said there were 2 of them. The point of this text is not to say, because I've heard people go on about the 10 and how it relates to the 12 tribes and you know, is this the church and is this half the church? No. All it's saying is there are some that are wise and there are some that are foolish, and we need to know why. And so he goes on, he says, let's hear about why they're wise and why they're foolish. And he says, There were five wise, for when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. He said, half the group anticipated that the party may go on longer than expected. And they were going to be ready, and so they had their lamps, and they also had extra flasks of oil to fill their lamps when their lamps ran out of oil. And they're called wise. And another group over here came with their lamps. Hey, what's your job? My job is to bring the lamp. I'm to provide light when it gets dark. Okay, great. What have you got? I've got my lamp. Well, how long is that going to last? I don't know. A couple hours. What if the party goes longer? Oh. That's all that's being said. Five came prepared and five not. And so then he tells the story. He says, so what happened in this parable? Well, what happened was the bridegroom was delayed. It took longer than expected for whatever reason. Don't speculate on the reason. There's, you know, I've heard whole sermons talked about what delayed the bridegroom in his coming. And, you know, I remember one in particular, you know, that the bridegroom will not return until everyone who is supposed to be saved is saved. And we're actually delaying the coming of Christ because we're not preaching the gospel yet. And that's, so, you know, yeah, I mean, I've heard these kind of things out of this text. You know, what delayed the bridegroom? Jesus doesn't say. We don't know. I don't care. Not the point of the story. Not the point of the story. The bridegroom was delayed. And so the light bringers were providing light, but the party hadn't started yet. And in this context, all of a sudden, the five who didn't have any extra oil found that our lamps are going out. Now, they think they've got an easy solution to this. We'll just ask the ones who have oil. Hey, you with the oil, our lamps are going out, and we hear the bridegroom is coming. Can we have some of your oil? Now, I'm not going to make a big thing out of this either, because you say, well, they were pretty mean. They didn't share. No, what it says is this. It says, the wise answered, since there will not be enough for us and for you. Since there will not be enough. This isn't about being, you know, nasty or about. They're saying, you know what? If this party goes on like some I've been at, and we now take the oil we have and burn it over 10 lamps instead of 5, it's going to go out twice as fast. We may not have enough. In fact, we're pretty sure we don't have enough for all 10 of us to burn our lamps and get through the whole party. So better to have 5 lamps that go through the whole party than 10 lamps that don't make it, because I don't want to be the one, when the lights go out, having the bride come up to me and say, hey, where'd the lights go? You know, you just ruined my party. I got to send everybody home because there's no light. They said, we want to be, because why? Because my job is to be a light bringer. My job is to have, that's the only job the bridegroom gave me. That's the only job for this thing. I was told to have my lamp ready and provide the light for as long as the party lasted. So no, if I give my oil to you, we won't have enough. I tell you what, why don't you go to the lamp oil store? And you get what you need at the lamp oil store, and when you're ready, come back again. All right. So they go. Now, a lot is said here, you know, about midnight, the bridegroom came. The text says in the middle of the night. One of the other texts talks about the watches, and is it a Roman watch or a Jewish watch? Not the point of the story. The point of the story is it's been a long time, it's dark out, it's the middle of the night, and the bridegroom shows up. And you say, what do I have to do? I have to go get more oil at the lamp oil store in the middle of the night. So, you know what? Go and knock on the lamp oil store owner's bedroom window and say, hey, Mr. Lamp Oil Store owner, I'm supposed to be providing light for the wedding down the street, and my oil ran out. Would you please go open your shop and sell me some oil so I can do my job? And he's going to go, why did you wait until now? You could have come earlier and gotten this when the store was open and it was daylight and it was the time to be prepared. Why did you wait until now? Why weren't you ready? Now, that's not all said here, but that's because what it says is that while they were going to buy, wherever that was, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went. and those who were not ready didn't. That's what's implied there. And they went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. And afterward, the other virgins came also saying, you know what I really love about this? Just again, I don't know if they had the oil or not. It doesn't say whether they found any oil. It doesn't say whether they were now fully prepared or not. It just says that they finally reached the point where they came and said, hey, we want to be in the party too. And so they came and they said, master of the party, Lord, Lord, bridegroom, bridegroom, we're here. Let us in. And he says, truly, I say to you, I do not know you. People go, that was really harsh. Maybe hear it this way. Weren't you supposed to be the ones who brought the light?
Yeah.
Where is it? You don't have any? Well, then, I don't have a place for you. You weren't ready. You weren't ready, so there's not a place for you. Why do I say it? Because here's the whole point. This whole thing is about verse 13. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. See, way back in verse 36 of chapter 34, he said, chapter 24, he said, concerning the day and the hour, no one knows. No one knows. No one knows. Not even the Son. You don't know. The angels don't know. Not even the Son. This is something that God is doing in his perfect plan. And no one knows. So, what's the lesson? Watch, therefore, and be prepared. That's it. That's all there is to it. You say, I want to know about the second coming of Christ. Let me tell you the two things that are most important about the second coming of Christ. One is he is coming back. He is coming back. He is coming back. Count on it. Log it. It's a fact. He's coming back. And some will be ready and some won't. There's your eschatology in a nutshell. There's the whole coming of Christ in a nutshell. He is coming back, and when he does, some will be ready and some won't. Which one are you? Which one are you? You say, well, Dave, what does it mean for me to be prepared? How do I know if I'm prepared? I want to be prepared. Can I be prepared? What's prepared look like? Well, there's a whole lot that we can see in other scriptures, but I'm going to start with a couple of basics, like who are you waiting for in the first place? Are you expecting Jesus? You know, we go through lives waiting and expecting a lot of things. You know what I see in this story? I see that it says it's like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. They had a purpose, and that was they were going to meet the bridegroom. That's what they were there to do. They were expecting the bridegroom. What are you expecting? You know, we expect a lot of things. We expect retirement. We expect vacation. We expect to see friends. We expect to, I don't know. What do you expect for things in the future? You expect to do better in your job. You expect to, I don't know. But can you tell me honestly the thought crossed your mind even once in the last day, week, month, year? I'm expecting Jesus today. You know, it changes your whole way of thinking. And Wendy went out to see her parents and spend some time out there. Her mom and dad have been going through a rough patch, and the four siblings have been gathering. My sister-in-law from Florida is up there right now caring for them. Wendy's probably going to go out a little later this summer and spend some time helping mom and dad. That's good. So she was gone for a few days back over Easter, and then she came home. You know, I was expecting her to come home. You have no idea how long it takes me to recover the house after she's been gone for 3 days, so it's ready for her when I expect her to come home. I mean, I am a cleaning maniac. I am scrubbing and washing and dusting and folding and straightening and primping and, you know, because why? Because I expect her to come home, and when she does, I want it to be ready. I'm expecting Wendy to come home. Are you expecting Jesus to come today? Let's start with, are we even expecting him to come? And then the second thing is, are we doing the job we were asked to do? See, that's the whole thing here. These virgins, these bridesmaids were given a job. You're to be the ones who have the light. So what was their job? To be prepared with the light, ready to go. So they had their lamps and they had them filled. They were prepared and ready whenever the bridegroom came. What has God asked you to do? He's asked you to be a faithful man or woman. He's asked you to be a good husband or father. He's asked you to be an obedient child, or he's asked you to be, how about a faithful witness? There's some things that God has asked us to do, to be holy as he is holy, to walk in grace and truth, to be prepared to give an answer in season and out of season. There's some things he's asked us to do. And he wants to know, as the ones who were left to be his witnesses, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. We weren't asked to be light bringers in the dark in that, well, maybe in the metaphorical sense of the light of the world, but we, these girls had a task. And the question is, are they ready to do their job? We have been given tasks by the one that we are expecting to come back again, and the question is, are we ready with our job? Now, don't push this too far. That doesn't mean, if I don't do my job, does that mean I'm cast out of the kingdom? No, that's not what it's saying. But, there is that teaching that we see where it talks about the works we do and how they'll be tested by fire. And if all we did was invest in the worthlessness of this life, wood, hay, and stubble, it gets burned up. But if we invest in the eternal things, then it's like gold, silver, and precious stones that survive the testing by fire. And those rewards go with us. And so, So first of all, are we even expecting Jesus? And then if we are we doing what he asked us to do? Are we doing the jobs we were assigned? And then I think there's something else that's aware here. Are we constantly preparing for the unexpected or for the change, Or do we just think, I've got this, my little thing? When I thought about this, when I kind of thought about the whole task of being prepared to be witnesses, it looks a lot different to be Christ's witness to a lost world in the year 2019 than it did in the year 1919. If your whole approach to being a witness is what you did in 1975, you're probably not nearly as effective now because the world has changed. The message hasn't, but the world has. And so sometimes we have to connect differently. We have to express differently. It's kind of like having enough oil for the changing conditions in which we were called to serve. Are you prepared? Are you prepared for what's next, not just what's now? See, one group of girls was prepared for what's now, but they hadn't given any thought to what's next. See, when I look at this, I realize, you say, what can we learn from this? We can learn that, one, we need to be expecting Jesus. We need to be doing what he's asked us to do. We need to be prepared for what's next as we do it, because we don't know how long until he comes, but we need to be prepared, be prepared, be prepared, be prepared. And then finally, I think we need to remember what's at stake, because it's easy to forget. When you go to the end of this passage and Jesus was talking about it with his disciples, he says to them in verse 31 and following, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and the angels with him, there will be, and he will sit on his throne, glorious throne, before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate the peoples one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he talks about the sheep on the right and the goats on the left, and what? And he goes, it's a judgment. It's a judgment. In the book of Hebrews, in chapter 11, remember, the book of Hebrews was written to the Jewish people, and so it calls on their traditions and histories, and the book of Hebrews is basically saying that Jesus was greater than the prophets, and greater than those angels who came and ministered, and greater than the temple and its systems and images and sacrifices and all that went with it. Jesus is greater than these. And he writes in verse 23 of chapter 11, thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with a better sacrifice than these. For Christ has entered not only into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but he has also entered into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as the high priest enters the holy place every year with the blood that is not his own, for then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Well, what's that whole point? It's to say this: Jesus has dealt with sin when he dealt with it on the cross. And he did that in an amazing way, which is superior to all the other sacrifices. And he has covered sin for everybody. So what's next? What's next is when he comes back to finally bring to completion the salvation that he began there. And he's going to do that for those people who understand that they've been saved, who know who he is, and who are eagerly waiting for him to come, because they want more than anything else to be free from this broken world and brought into that place, as Jesus told his disciples, that he has prepared for them. I go to prepare a place, and if I go, I will come again to receive you to myself, that where I am, there you also may be, Jesus said. He went to do that, and he is coming back to bring that salvation and that fruition and that completion to those who are eagerly waiting for him. I'm going to ask the deacons to go ahead and step out and begin to prepare for the time we're going to spend around the Lord's table, and get the band and all up here for a minute. As we do that, I want us to think about that statement Paul made. As often as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again. We take these elements, we take this cup, and we take this bread, and we say, Jesus died for me. Jesus died for you. The song we sang at the cross, two wonders I confess, my worth and my unworthiness. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? How can both be the same? Well, it's this way. My worth, in that I was so valuable to Christ that he was willing to pay that sacrifice to redeem me. He died for my sin and my unworthiness. I can never be worthy of that love, of that truth, of that grace, of that power. When we take these elements and we understand, remember what Jesus did for us, here's the difference. It's real easy to go, oh, he did that for me, and get all like this. But we also need to go, and he did that for you. We need to proclaim the Lord's death, his death by which every person out in the world who is trapped by that devil that we talked about last week, every person who is caught in sin, every person who right now is about to be shut out when the door is closed, we need to take that message to them. And we need to proclaim it and proclaim it and proclaim it and proclaim it until the day that he comes back again. And we need to say, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Because we want everybody to be ready. Jesus wants everybody to be ready. Jesus wants everybody at that banquet table. Jesus wants everybody at that feast. Well, we may know that some will say no, some will be foolish. We want to make sure that we have done our job and that we have carried that gospel message to a lost world. There it is. Jesus is coming back. He'll do it when and how he wants. When he does, we'll say, that was cool, that was great. And the only real question is, are you ready?